This is audio book of Invisible Helpers by C.W. Leadbeater, American Revised Edition 1915. Chapter 1. The Universal Belief in Them. It is one of the most beautiful characteristics of theosophy that it gives back to people in a more rational form everything which was really useful and helpful to them in the religions which they have outgrown. Many who have broken through the chrysalis of blind faith and mounted on the wings of reason and intuition to the freer, nobler mental life of more exalted levels, nevertheless feel that in the process of this glorious gainer something has been lost, that in giving up the beliefs of their childhood they have also cast aside much of the beauty and the poetry of life. If, however, their lives in the past have been sufficiently good to earn for them the opportunity of coming under the benign influence of theosophy, they very soon discover that even in this particular there has been no loss at all, but an exceeding great gain, that the glory and the beauty and the poetry are there in fuller measure than they had ever hoped before, and no longer is a mere pleasant dream from which the cold light of common sense may at any time rudely awaken them, but as truths of nature which will bear investigation, which become only brighter, fuller and more perfect as they are more accurately understood. A marked instance of this beneficent action of theosophy is the way in which the invisible world, which, before the great wave of materialism engulfed us, used to be regarded as the source of all living help, has been restored by it to modern life. All the charming folklore of the elf, the brownie and the gnome, of the spirits of air and water, of the forest, the mountain and the mine, is shown by it to be no more meaningless superstition, but to have a basis of actual and scientific fact behind it. Its answer to the great fundamental question, if a man die, shall he live again, is equally definite and scientific, and its teaching on the nature and conditions of the life after death throws a flood of light upon much that, for the Western world at least, was previously wrapped in impenetrable darkness. It cannot be too often repeated that in this teaching as to the immortality of the soul and the life after death, theosophy stands in a position totally different from that of ordinary religion. It does not put forward these great truths merely on their authority of some sacred book of long ago. In speaking of these subjects, it is not dealing with pious opinions or metaphysical speculations, but with solid, definite facts, as real and as close to us as the air we breathe or the houses we live in, facts of which many among us have constant experience, facts among which lies the daily work of some of our students, as will presently be seen. Among the beautiful conceptions which theosophy has restored to us stands preeminent that of the great helpful agencies of nature. The belief in these has been worldwide from the earliest dawn of history, and is universal even now outside the narrow domains of Protestantism, which has emptied and darkened the world for its votaries by its attempt to do away with the natural and perfectly true idea of intermediate agents, and reduce everything to two factors of man and deity, a device whereby the conception of deity has been infinitely degraded, and man has remained unhelped. A moment's thought will show that the ordinary view of providence, the conception of an erratic interference by the central power of the universe with the result of his own decrees, would imply the introduction of partiality into the scheme, and therefore of the whole train of evils which must necessarily follow upon its heels. The theosophical teaching, that a man can be thus specially helped only when his past actions have been such as to deserve this assistance, and that even then the help will be given through those who are comparatively near his own level, is free from this serious objection, and it furthermore brings back to us the older and far grander conception of an unbroken ladder of living beings extending down from the Logos himself to the very dust beneath our feet. In the East, the existence of the invisible helpers has always been recognized, though the names given and the characteristics attributed to them naturally vary in different countries. And even in Europe we have had the old Greek stories of the constant interference of the gods in human affairs, and the Roman legend that Castor and Pollux led the legions of the infant republic in the Battle of Lake Regillus. Nor did such a conception die out when the classical period ended, for these stories have their legitimate successors in medieval tales of saints who appeared at critical moments and turned the fortune of war in favor of the Christian hosts, or of guardian angels who sometimes stepped in and saved a pious traveler from what would otherwise have been certain destruction. Chapter 2. Some modern instances. Even in this incredulous age, and amidst the full whirl of our 19th century civilization, in spite of the dogmatism of our science and the deadly dullness of our Protestantism, instances of intervention inexplicable from the materialistic standpoint may still be found by anyone who will take the trouble to look for them. And in order to demonstrate this to the reader, I will briefly epitomize a few of the examples given in one or other of the recent collections of such stories, adding thereto one or two that have come within my own notice. One very remarkable feature of these more recent examples is that the intervention seems nearly always to have been directed towards the helping or saving of children. An interesting case which occurred in London only a few years ago was connected with the preservation of a child's life in the midst of a terrible fire, which broke out in a street near Holborn, and entirely destroyed two of the houses there. The flames had obtained such hold before they were discovered that the firemen were unable to save the houses, but they succeeded in rescuing all the inmates except two, an old woman who was suffocated by the smoke before they could reach her, and a child about 5 years old, whose presence in the house had been forgotten in the hurry and excitement of the moment. The mother of the child, it seems, was a friend or relative of the landlady of the house, and had left the little creature in her charge for the night, because she was herself obliged to go down to Colchester on business. It was not until everyone else had been rescued, and the whole house was wrapped in flame, that the landlady remembered with a terrible pang the trust that had been confided to her. It seemed hopeless then to attempt to get at the garret where the child had been put to bed, but one of the firemen heroically resolved to make the desperate effort, and, after receiving minute directions as to the exact situation of the room, plunged in among the smoke and flame. He found the child, and brought him forth entirely unharmed, but when he rejoined his comrades he had a very singular story to tell. He declared that when he reached the room he found it in flames, and most of the floor already fallen, but the fire had curved round the room towards the window in an unnatural and unaccountable manner, the like of which in all his experience he had never seen before, so that the corner in which the child lay was wholly untouched, although the very rafters of the fragment of floor on which his little crib stood were half burnt away. The child was naturally very much terrified, but the fireman distinctly and repeatedly declared that as at great risk he made his way towards him he saw a form like an angel. Here his exact words are given: something all gloriously white and silvery, bending over the bed and smoothing down the counterpane. He could not possibly have been mistaken about it, he said, for it was visible in a glare of light for some moments, and in fact disappeared only when he was within a few feet of it. Another curious feature of this story is that the child's mother found herself unable to sleep that night down in Colchester, but was constantly harassed by a strong feeling that something was wrong with her child, insomuch that at last she was compelled to rise and spend some time in earnest prayer that the little one might be protected from the danger which she instinctively felt to be hanging over him. The intervention was thus evidently what a Christian would call an answer to a prayer. A theosophist, putting the same idea in more scientific phraseology, would say that her intense outpouring of love constituted a force which one of our visible helpers was able to use for the rescue of her child from a terrible death. A remarkable case in which children were abnormally protected occurred on the banks of the Thames near Maidenhead a few years earlier than our last example. This time the danger from which they were saved arose not from fire but from water. Three little ones, who lived, if I recollect rightly, in or near the village of Shotsbrook, were taken out for a walk along the towing path by their nurse. They rushed suddenly round a corner upon a horse which was drawing a barge, and in the confusion two of them got on the wrong side of the tow rope and were thrown into the water. The boatman, who saw the accident, sprang forward to try to save them, and he noticed that they were floating high in the water. In quite an unnatural way, like, as he said, and moving quietly towards the bank. This was all that he and the nurse saw, but the children each declared that a beautiful person, all white and shining, stood beside them in the water, held them up and guided them to the shore. Nor was their story without corroboration, for the bargeman's little daughter, who ran up from the cabin when she heard the screams of the nurse, also affirmed that she saw a lovely lady in the water dragging the two children to the bank. Without fuller particulars than the story gives us, it is impossible to say with certainty from what class of helpers this angel was drawn, but the probabilities are in favor of its having been a developed human being functioning in the astral body, as will be seen when later on we deal with this subject from the other side, as it were, from the point of view of the helpers rather than the helped. A case in which the agency is somewhat more definitely distinguishable is related by the well-known clergyman, Dr. John Mason Neal. He states that a man who had recently lost his wife was on a visit with his little children at the country house of a friend. It was an old, rambling mansion, and in the lower part of it there were long, dark passages, in which the children played about with great delight. But presently they came upstairs very gravely, and two of them related that as they were running down one of these passages they were met by their mother, who told them to go back again, and then disappeared. Investigation revealed the fact that if the children had run but a few steps farther they would have fallen down a deep uncovered well which yawned full in their path, so that the apparition of their mother had saved them from almost certain death. In this instance there seems no reason to doubt that the mother herself was still keeping a loving watch over her children from the astral plane, and that, as has happened in some other cases, her intense desire to warn them of the danger into which they were so heedlessly rushing gave her the power to make herself visible and audible to them for the moment, or perhaps merely to impress their minds with the idea that they saw and heard her. It is possible, of course, that the helper may have been someone else, who took the familiar form of the mother in order not to alarm the children, but the simplest hypothesis is to attribute the intervention to the action of the ever-wakeful mother love itself, undimmed by the passage through the gates of death. This mother love, being one of the holiest and most unselfish of human feelings, is also one of the most persistent on higher planes. Not only does the mother who finds herself upon the lower levels of the astral plane, and consequently still within touch of the earth, maintain her interest in and her care for her children as long as she is able to see them, even after her entry into the heaven world these little ones are still the most prominent objects in her thought, and the wealth of love that she lavishes upon the images which she then makes of them is a great outpouring of spiritual force which flows down upon her offspring who are still struggling in this lower world, and surrounds them with living centers of beneficent energy which may not inaptly be described as veritable guardian angels. An illustration of this will be found in the 6th of our Theosophical Manuals, page 38. Not long ago the little daughter of one of our English bishops was out walking with her mother in the town where they lived, and in running heedlessly across a street the child was knocked down by the horses of a carriage which came quickly upon her round a corner. Seeing her among the horses' feet, the mother rushed forward, expecting to find her very badly injured, but she sprang up quite merrily, saying, "Oh, mamma, I am not at all hurt, for something all in white kept their horses from treading upon me, and told me not to be afraid." A case which occurred in Buckinghamshire, somewhere in the neighbourhood of Burnham Beeches, is remarkable on account of the length of time through which the physical manifestation of the succouring agency seems to have maintained itself. It will have been seen that in the instances hitherto given the intervention was a matter of but a few moments, whereas in this a phenomenon was produced which appears to have persisted for more than half an hour. Two of the little children of a small farmer were left to amuse themselves while their parents and their entire household were engaged in the work of harvesting. The little ones started for a walk in the woods, wandered far from home, and then managed to lose their way. When the weary parents returned at dusk it was discovered that the children were missing, and after inquiring at some of the neighbors' houses the father sent servants and laborers in various directions to seek for them. Their efforts were, however, unsuccessful, and their shouts unanswered, and they had reassembled at the farm in a somewhat despondent frame of mind, when they all saw a curious light some distance away moving slowly across some fields towards the road. It was described as a large globular mass of rich golden glow, quite unlike ordinary lamplight, and as it drew nearer it was seen that the two missing children were walking steadily along in the midst of it. The father and some others immediately set off running towards it. The appearance persisted until they were close to it, but just as they grasped the children it vanished, leaving them in the darkness. The children's story was that after night came on they had wandered about crying in the woods for some time, and had at last lain down under a tree to sleep. They had been roused, they said, by a beautiful lady with a lamp, who took them by the hand and led them home. When they questioned her she smiled at them, but never spoke a word. To this strange tale they both steadily adhered, nor was it possible in any way to shake their faith in what they had seen. It is noteworthy, however, that though all present saw the light, and noticed that it lit up the trees and hedges which came within its sphere precisely as an ordinary light would, yet the form of the lady was visible to none but the children. Chapter 3. A Personal Experience. All the above stories are comparatively well known, and may be found in some of the books which contain collections of such accounts, most of them in Drive.S More Glimpses of the World Unseen, but the two instances which I am now about to give have never been in print before, and both occurred within the last 10 years, one to myself, and the other to a very dear friend of mine, a prominent member of the Theosophical Society, whose accuracy of observation is beyond all shadow of doubt. My own story is a simple one enough, though not unimportant to me, since the interposition undoubtedly saved my life. I was walking one exceedingly wet and stormy night down a quiet back street near Westbourne Grove, struggling with scant success to hold up an umbrella against the savage gusts of wind that threatened every moment to tear it from my grasp, and trying as I labored along to think out the details of some work upon which I was just then engaged. With startling suddenness a voice which I know well, the voice of an Indian teacher, cried in my ear, "Spring back!" And in mechanical obedience I started violently backwards almost before I had time to think. As I did so my umbrella, which had swung forward with the sudden movement, was struck from my hand and a huge metal chimney pot crashed upon the pavement less than a yard in front of my face. The great weight of this article, and the tremendous force with which it fell, make it absolutely certain that but for the warning voice I should have been killed on the spot. Yet the street was empty, and the voice was that of one whom I knew to be 7,000 miles away from me, as far as the physical body was concerned. Nor was this the only occasion upon which I received assistance of this supernormal kind, for in early life, long before the foundation of the Theosophical Society, the apparition of a dear one who had recently died prevented me from committing what I now see would have been a serious crime, although by the light of such knowledge as I then had it appeared not only a justifiable but even a laudable act of retaliation. Again, at a later date, though still before the foundation of this society, the warning conveyed to me from a higher plane amid most impressive surroundings enabled me to prevent another man from entering upon a course which I now know would have ended disastrously, though I had no reason to suppose so at the time. So it will be seen that I have a certain amount of personal experience to strengthen my belief in the doctrine of invisible helpers, even apart from my knowledge of the help that is constantly being given at the present time. The other case is a very much more striking one. One of our members, who gives me permission to publish her story, but does not wish her name mentioned, once found herself in very serious physical peril. Owing to circumstances which need not be detailed here, she was in the very center of a dangerous street fracas, and seeing several men struck down and evidently badly hurt close to her, was in momentary expectation of a similar fate, since escape from the crush seemed quite impossible. Suddenly she experienced a curious sensation of being whirled out of the crowd, and found herself standing quite uninjured and entirely alone in a small by-street parallel with the one in which the disturbance had taken place. She still heard the noise of the struggle, and while she stood wondering what on earth had happened to her, two or three men who had escaped from the crowd came running round the corner of the street, and on seeing her expressed great astonishment and pleasure, saying that when the brave lady so suddenly disappeared from the midst of the fight they had felt certain that she had been struck down. At the time no sort of explanation was forthcoming, and she returned home in a very mystified condition. But when at a later period she mentioned this strange occurrence to Madame Blavatsky, she was informed that, her karma being such as to enable her to be saved from her exceedingly dangerous position, one of the masters had specially sent someone to protect her in view of the fact that her life was needed for the work. Nevertheless, the case remains a very extraordinary one, both with regard to the great amount of power exercised and the unusually public nature of its manifestation. It is not difficult to imagine the modus operandi. She must have been lifted bodily over the intervening block of houses, and simply set down in the next street, but since her physical body was not visible floating in the air, it is also evident that a veil of some sort, probably of etheric matter, must have been thrown round her while in transit. If it be objected that whatever can hide physical matter must itself be physical, and therefore visible, it may be replied that by a process familiar to all occult students it is possible to bend rays of light, which, under all conditions at present known to science, travel only in straight lines unless refracted, so that after passing round an object they may resume exactly their former course, and it will at once be seen that if this were done such an object would to all physical eyes be absolutely invisible until the rays were allowed to resume their normal course. I am fully aware that this one statement alone is sufficient to brand any remarks as nonsense in the eyes of the scientist of the present day, but I cannot help that. I am merely stating a possibility in nature which the science of the future will no doubt one day discover, and for those who are not students of occultism a remark must wait until then for its justification. The process, as I say, is comprehensible enough to anyone who understands a little about the more occult forces of nature, but the phenomenon still remains an exceedingly dramatic one, while the name of the heroine of the story, were I permitted to give it, would be a guarantee of its accuracy to all my readers. Another recent instance of interposition, less striking, perhaps, but entirely successful, has been reported to me since the publication of the first edition of this book. A lady, being obliged to undertake a long railway journey alone, had taken the precaution to secure an empty compartment, but just as the train was leaving the station, a man of forbidding and villainous appearance sprang in and seated himself at the other end of the carriage. The lady was much alarmed, thus to be left alone with so doubtful a character, but it was too late to call for help, so she sat still and commended herself earnestly to the care of her patron saint. Soon her fears were redoubled, for the man arose and turned toward her with an evil grin. But he had hardly taken one step when he started back with a look of the most intense astonishment and terror. Following the direction of his glance, she was startled to see a gentleman seated directly opposite to her, gazing quietly but firmly at the baffled robber, a gentleman who certainly could not have entered the carriage by any ordinary means. Too much awed to speak, she watched him as though fascinated for a full half hour. He uttered no word, and did not even look at her, but kept his eyes steadily upon the villain, who cowered trembling in the furthest corner of the compartment. The moment that the train reached the next station, and even before it came to a standstill, the would-be thief tore open the door and sprang hurriedly out. The lady, deeply thankful to be rid of him, turned to express her gratitude to the gentleman, but found only an empty seat, though it would have been impossible for any physical body to have left the carriage in the time. The materialization was in this case maintained for a longer period than usual, but on the other hand it expended no force in action of any kind, nor indeed was it necessary that it should do so, as its mere appearance was sufficient to effect its purpose. But these stories, all referring as they do to what would commonly be called angelic intervention, illustrate only one small part of the activities of our invisible helpers. Before, However, we can profitably consider the other departments of their work. It will be well that we should have clearly in our minds the various classes of entities to which it is possible that these helpers may belong. Let that, then, be the portion of our subject to be next treated. Chapter 4. The Helpers. Help, then, may be given by several of the many classes of inhabitants of the astral plane. It may come from devas, from nature spirits, or from those whom we call dead, as well as from those who function consciously upon the astral plane during life, chiefly the adepts and their pupils. But if we examine the matter a little more closely, we shall see that though all the classes mentioned may, and sometimes do, take a part in this work, yet their shares in it are so unequal that it is practically left almost entirely to one class. The very fact that so much of this work of helping has to be done either upon or from the astral plane goes far in itself towards explaining this. To anyone who has even a faint idea of what the powers at the command of an adept really are, it will be at once obvious that for him to work upon the astral plane would be a far greater waste of energy than for our leading physicians or scientists to spend their time in breaking stones upon the road. The work of the adept lies in higher regions, chiefly upon the upper levels of the Devachanic plane or heaven world, where he may direct his energies to the influencing of the true individuality of man, and not the mere personality which is all that can be reached in the astral or physical world. The strength which he puts forth in that more exalted realm produces results greater, more far-reaching and more lasting than any which can be attained by the expenditure of even 10 times the force down here, and the work up there is such as he alone can fully accomplish, while that on lower planes may be at any rate to some extent achieved by whose feet are yet upon the earlier steps of the great stairway which will one day lead them to the position where he stands. The same remarks apply also in the case of the devas. Belonging as they do to a higher kingdom of nature than ours, their work seems for the most part entirely unconnected with humanity, and even those of their orders, and there are some such, which do sometimes respond to our higher yearnings or appeals, do so on the mental plane rather than on the physical or astral, and more frequently in the periods between our incarnations than during our earthly lives. It may be remembered that some instances of such help were observed in the course of investigations into the subdivisions of the Devachanic plane which were undertaken when the Theosophical Manual on the subject was in preparation. In one case a deva was found teaching the most wonderful celestial music to a chorister, and in another one of a different class was giving instruction and guidance to an astronomer who was seeking to comprehend the form and structure of the universe. These two were but examples of many instances in which the great deva kingdom was found to be helping onward the evolution and responding to the higher aspirations of man after death, and there are methods by which, even during earth life, these great ones may be approached, and an infinity of knowledge acquired from them, though even then such intercourse is gained rather by rising to their plane than by invoking them to descend to ours. In the ordinary events of our physical life the deva very rarely interferes, indeed, he is so fully occupied with the far grander work of his own plane that he is probably scarcely conscious of this, and though it may occasionally happen that he becomes aware of some human sorrow or difficulty which excites his pity and moves him to endeavor to help in some way, his wider vision undoubtedly recognizes that at the present stage of evolution such interpositions would in the vast majority of cases be productive of infinitely more harm than good. There was indubitably a period in the past, in the infancy of the human race, when it was much more largely assisted from outside than is at present the case. At the time when all its Buddhas and Manas, and even its more ordinary leaders and teachers, were drawn either from the ranks of the deva evolution or from the perfected humanity of a more advanced planet, any such assistance as we are considering in this treatise must also have been given by these exalted beings. But as man progresses he becomes himself qualified to act as a helper, first on the physical plane and then on higher levels, and we have now reached a stage at which humanity ought to be able to provide, and to some slight extent does provide, invisible helpers for itself, thus setting free for still more useful and elevated work those beings who are capable of it. It becomes obvious then that such assistance as that to which we are here referring may most fitly be given by men and women at a particular stage of their evolution, not by the adepts, since they are capable of doing far grander and more widely useful work, and not by the ordinary person of no special spiritual development, for he would be unable to be of any use.